Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Rick Karneski, Program Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce the distinguished moderator, Catherine Nielsen. Catherine is the co-director of the Science, Health, and Education Partnership at UCSF. She spent nearly 15 years there, for many years leading TRIAD, a gender equity in science program. She became SEPS co-director in 2005, overseeing several K-12 education programs, including the high school intern program, and she's the 2011 recipient of the Presidential Medal for Excellence in Science, Mathematics, and Engineering Mentoring. She also is the co-author of Girls in Science, a Framework for Action from NSTA Press. Please join me in welcoming Catherine Nielsen, who will introduce the rest of our distinguished panelists.
Thank you, Rick, and good evening, everyone. I'm really pleased to be here tonight for our panel discussing women and underrepresented students of color in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM for short. The global competitiveness of the United States and our state of California has in part been attributed to our aptitude in these fields. Yet many fear that we are losing our lead. Despite the high demand and compensation in many STEM fields, there is a scarcity of women and underrepresented students of color entering and persevering in these fields. Tonight, with our panel, we'll discuss the barriers and biases that have contributed to this gap and also talk about strategies for addressing it. So I really want to thank you all for being with us here tonight and thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting this discussion. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. Whoops. So going down, here we have Maynard Holliday. He is the 2012 President's Volunteer Service Award winner and was Volunteer of the Year for Citizen Schools. He is a researcher at Sandia National Laboratories and co-founded the Robot Garden Community Hackerspace in Livermore. Next to Maynard is Sue Rosser. She is Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at San Francisco State University and author, most recently, of Breaking Into the Lab, Engineering Progress for Women in Science. Professor Rosser is a noted scientist and administrator who has written widely on the subject of women and science. And then finally, we have Jarvis Sulzer, who is Executive Director of the Level Playing Field Institute. Jarvis joined the Level Playing Field in 2007, first as academic director and most recently serving as the Director of Education, overseeing the Summer Math and Science Honors Academy. And we'd like to just begin by having each of our panelists briefly describe their work to improve STEM education for women and or underrepresented students of color. And we'll just go in order, probably, to start with. So, Maynard.
Thank you for that introduction. I come to STEM from, a background of, great passion and interest, and during my 25-plus-year career, I've noticed a paucity of people who look like me in the places that I've worked. And I consciously decided to try to give back the best way I could, which was be a role model and talk to kids, of all races and colors. And I started in my kids' school first. And then I learned about a program 3 years ago called Citizen Schools that partners with low-performing schools in urban areas to extend the school day and provide apprenticeships to students taught by volunteers like myself who are very passionate about a subject. And so I began teaching at Elmhurst Community Prep in East Oakland on 98th Avenue and teaching robotics to 6th and 7th graders. And I found that, you know, was very rewarding because I was engaged with them on a weekly basis. We did project-based learning, and at the end, we did something called a WOW, where the students presented their projects to their peers, their parents, and the community. And it's a very powerful experience, and I'm hooked. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, and I continue to look for opportunities to talk to students and touch them and ignite the spark that was ignited in me so many years ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you also for that introduction. So I first became interested in these issues back in the early 70s, just after I received my PhD. And I was asked to participate in the first women's studies program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and teach the biology of women class. For me, this was a revelation because I realized that despite the fact that I had a PhD in biology and it had two children by that point, there was so much I didn't know about my own body. And this was because at that time women were not considered in many of the clinical trials. They were not included. And there was an absence of information pertaining to women in science and engineering. And so I began to see that this could be very important on the research level in terms of it really informed the kinds of questions that were asked, sometimes depending upon who was doing the asking. Then my first teaching position was at a women's college, and that's when I got into really the possible differences in science education. I could see that compared to my experience at co-educational institutions, the way I subtly changed the examples I used, the approaches that I would take in order to appeal to the students that I was teaching, who in that case were all women, made them more attracted to the content, and I saw that this was a pedagogical technique that would be useful. So then I moved to a co-educational institution, and I started mainstreaming some of this content and approach into classes and expanded that for faculty at different types of institutions because I'd already gone into administration. So I was working with two-year institutions, four-year institutions, and a research institution. National Science Foundation became interested in my work, and they not only funded it, but then they asked me to come there and be senior program officer for women's programs. This was in the 1990s, and that was a very exciting time, and we were able to develop some model programs from around the country. But eventually we realized that just giving the money to individual investigators wasn't enough. We weren't moving the numbers. There had been flat percentages of women in many disciplines, such as physics, for about four decades at that point. And so we looked towards making systemic changes, and that led to the development of the ADVANCE program, which is now available to universities, to try to get women into more senior and leadership positions in science and engineering at the level of full professor, chair, dean, president, and so on. So, and that's by making systemic changes in the institutions themselves to make them more attractive to women. I guess you could say that my interest has kind of paralleled where I was moving in my life span and story and what I was doing with my career.
Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for the introduction. My interest in STEM stemmed from my own upbringing. I mean, I'm a first-generation college student myself. I did my undergrad at Southern University in Louisiana in physics and did my minor in mathematics. And then I went on to Cornell University and pursued a master's and PhD in nuclear science and engineering. And through my journey from elementary school through college through graduate school, like Maynard, I was most of the times the only one. Even more so when I attended Cornell for graduate school. And when I went to conferences, typically I was the only one. And when I graduated from Cornell in 1998, I was the only African-American male in the United States to get a PhD in nuclear science and engineering in 1998. Then I went to work in industry in Silicon Valley. And in my group of about 300 scientists and engineers, I was the only one. And I made a promise at the graduate student that wherever I ended up, be it Silicon Valley or wherever in the United States, I was going to give back in ways that goes beyond just working at a high-tech company. And so I got introduced to LPFI, where I'm now the executive director, and our mission is to eliminate barriers for students of color in STEM and to foster their untapped potential. And the ways we do that is through our Summer Math and Science Honors Academy, which is a 3-year, 5-week residential program currently at UC Berkeley, Stanford, UCLA, and USC. And in this program, we serve high-achieving, low-income students of color, primarily first-generation students who have an interest in pursuing degrees in STEM. And SMASH, in a nutshell, is it bridges the gap between the aspiration these students have to pursue these careers and the preparation required for them to persist and graduate with a STEM degree. That's in a nutshell what SMASH does. We just recently launched a new program for middle school students, specifically focused on African-American males, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And the idea is to prepare these young men for programs like SMASH, because oftentimes we see not only SMASH but other STEM programs in the area, a dearth of qualified African-American male students. Even our own program, we struggle, and it's a common thing, not just in California, but I think it's nationally, having young men who are prepared. So we've decided to focus specifically to start with African-American males, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, to reach back beyond what we've been doing at SMASH since 2004, UC Berkeley. So, and in addition to the program we do, the two STEM programs, we also conduct research looking at inequities in access and opportunity for students of color in STEM through the K-12 pipeline.
Thank you. Since many of you mentioned actually the numbers and your own experience with being the one or one of few, maybe let's start with that, which is where are we today in terms of women and underrepresented students of color in STEM fields? So, Sue, do you want to start us off with
the... Sure. Well, in terms of women, compared to the 60s and 70s when I first entered, we've made vast strides in many areas so that now we have some what we call high participation fields. These would be psychology, where we have maybe 77% of the undergraduate and even graduate degrees going to women. Also the life sciences, we have reached parity both at the undergraduate level and also at the master's and PhD level. The sort of medium participation fields would be chemistry, mathematics, we're coming along in geosciences, and even physics has moved along. The sort of difficult stories are engineering, which is much better than it was in the 60s and 70s, where you had about 3% of women engineers. Now about 19% of the undergraduate degrees in engineering go to women. But a strange and oppositional story is computer science. The peak of women receiving degrees in computer science was 1984, when about 37% of the bachelor's degrees in computer science went to women. It's now about 17 or 18%. This last year. Master's degrees also have dropped since the mid-80s in computer science. Ironically, PhDs in computer science going to women have increased. So there's variation depending on the field, and you really have to take a look at the individual disciplines to see what's going on.
Thank you.
Jarvis? So in terms of primarily Latino and African-American students, first focus on secondary. So as in one example, computer science, AP computer science. In the state of California, 7% of the student population is African American. 53% of the student population is Latinos. When it comes to AP computer science, only 1% of African American students in California have actually taken an AP computer science course. Only 7% of the 53% of Latino students have taken an AP or even qualified to take an AP course because of the limited access to those type of classes at the schools that they attend. So you look at the gap, and given where industry is going, there's a need there. At the secondary level, about 11% of all engineering, specifically engineering and science degrees, of Latino African-American students, it's about 11%, which is still, that's combined, not talking about ensure that master's PhD is at the undergraduate level, a four-year degree. Then we get to the workforce, combined in terms of representation, it's about 9% total of African-American Latino students specifically. So there's been, in my mind, limited progress. There's been some progress, and this is important given the direction of the country. California is one of the five states that's a minority-majority state. And so when you look at the dearth of, you know, the lack of participation in these areas for this population, I think it begs to wonder how we're going to participate in the economy as it moves forward, given that the jobs are in these areas of STEM.
Thanks. All of you spoke about your work and how and your desire to support students in pursuing STEM careers, but I'd like to hear what role did others play in supporting you as you came up in your STEM career? Start with Maynard.
So I'll start. You know, I had two parents who graduated from HBCUs in North Carolina, you know, weren't permitted to, you know, apply to the Dukes and the University of North Carolina at the time, and so they were a Baptist minister and high school librarian, and so it got to a point where they could no longer help me with my homework, you know, around sixth, seventh grade, and I found neighbors, friends to get me through, you know, those classes, and then when I was taking AP classes, you know, and luckily my school offered them. They stepped up and were able to find tutors in our neighborhood to get me through, you know, high school AP physics and calculus. And then when I got to my undergraduate institution, Carnegie Mellon, they had, as a lot of schools do, have programs. Support programs for students of color to avail themselves of tutoring, course files, you know, things that the majority group has, you know, done for decades in the form of course files at fraternity houses and sorority houses, and that played a big part in my success.
I would say that a very important role that influenced me was Sputnik going up. It's not an individual, but when I was in late elementary school, Sputnik went up in this country, and that opened many opportunities. Science was seen as very prestigious. There were lots of programs such as Expanding Your Horizons, which still exists today, where they try to encourage women and also men of color to go into science and engineering. Furthermore, science and engineering was seen as a prestigious occupation, as something that we should be doing. It was a very important thing to do for the country. And although I wasn't sure I wanted to be a scientist, I did do something that we now know is very important from the research, which is I took all the math courses and all the science courses in high school that would prepare me for that, and even, you know, calculus as a senior. So that even though I entered college thinking I was going to be an English and French major, when the second semester of my first year I switched to science, I wasn't behind because I had that kind of preparation for it. Now, I did have, I have to admit, some negative interactions. There were no women faculty who were tenured professors in the biology department at that time at the University of Wisconsin, so there were no direct role models, and I had some questions about, you know, could you really do this? I didn't see anybody doing what I thought I wanted to do, and that did cause me some problems. And I have to say that one of the people who both encouraged me to go into science also sexually harassed me. And so that left me with ambiguous and mixed feelings, which I think often does happen to women in science, that you end up with these kind of mixed messages about that. On the other hand, I had some inspirational women who were in other fields who really helped me and pulled me along. And then as I got further along into my career, there were outstanding role models who made a big difference for me. So I would say that it was a mixed set of opportunities that included both national structural funding opportunities and pushes by federal agencies that made science prestigious, as well as individuals who made a difference.
For me, my parents, even though they did not attend college, played a very important role in my direction. Just the same for my father, he would always say, boy, you need to get something in your head. I don't care what kind of shoes you wear, you want, what kind of clothes you want to wear. Get something in your head, meaning to get education, because if you get education, no one can take that from you. You can twist your ankle playing football or basketball. You can, you know, in your career, you know, if you want to aspire to be an athlete. But if you get an education, it will put you in a different position and to do things that you cannot do just being an athlete. And so that was something that stuck with me. And when I go speak to parents and students, I always share that story. My father and mother encouraged me. So they played an important role. Also, teachers. My elementary school teacher, Miss Crawford. I learned my multiplication tables in our class, and that was the first indication that I think I'm pretty good at math. And I got some candy and some chocolate candy. I still remember this. I was competing with another young lady, Stacy Jimmons. I remember all these things, and I beat her by like one multiplication table. I got 9 times 7 right, you know, and she missed it. She was stumbling with it, and that was like, wow, I'm pretty good at this. And so Miss Crawford, and in high school was Miss Dyer, my Algebra 2 teacher. And then in high school, in college was Dr. Bagayoko, the first person I ever met who had a PhD, or even a scientist for that matter. And he encouraged me that, you know, my first day on campus, visiting as a high school student, he said, you should get a PhD in physics. Like, I'm trying to finish my high school degree, you know. So having someone who saw that potential in me, I think, was very important. And then my professor at Cornell, Dr. McGuire, who I still play tennis with to this day, was influential. So those were the individuals that played an important role in me achieving what I've been able to achieve, because I had, you know, slip-ups along the way. And I just shared this briefly. You know, I struggled in my first semester of high school. I mean, we hear the accolades, I have a PhD in engineering, but I almost got kicked out of high school. I had a 1-something GPA. And it wasn't from my tennis coach, and tennis was new because there was no tennis classes in my neighborhood, but they changed the school to a magnet school in my neighborhood, and so I was able to pick up tennis. And my coach encouraged me, and you're better than this. And my Algebra 2 teacher, who I was really almost fell in the class, said, you have so much potential, you're wasting it. And so having those individuals in my life, I mean, really, you know, got me back on the right track. Not that I was a bad kid, but went through my little, you know, teenage, you know, whatever you want to call it, rebellion or whatever, and it reflected in my grades. But so, the importance of role models, be it parents, be it teachers, a coach, I think are vitally important to any student being successful in whatever career path they choose.
Thank you. So we have a group here tonight really for this particular topic, but I'd love to hear why from each of you, why do you feel it's important that we achieve a greater diversity among our scientists and engineers? Jarvis, do you want to start us off?
Okay. I think there's a few reasons. One, I think a diverse engineering group, I would say, brings a perspective to problems that a homogeneous group cannot. I mean, looking at solutions in a particular community, dealing with pollution in a community. You know, when people have lived that experience, and now they're engineers, they bring a perspective to how to tackle problems in ways that a homogeneous group cannot bring, because they don't have that same perspective. So that's one, just, you know, generally, just with the expert, given you have the expertise and knowledge and understanding of what the problem is. Two is where the demand is. I mean, 16 out of the top 25 STEM occupation jobs in the future are all STEM related. So I think that's important, and a really good reason as to why we should have more students of color pursuing degrees in STEM. And then third, and I mentioned this earlier, is direction of the country in terms of the complexion of the country is changing. And when you got a majority of the population is going to be minorities, and yet very few are in the top careers, where they put them economically, politically, you know, decisions that are made, you know, at the highest level, we're not at the table, oftentimes we're left out. And so I think it's important. Those are my reasons why I think it's important.
Building on what he has suggested, I've often said that it's actually a matter of life and death that you have diversity in the pool of scientists and engineers. And that harks back to the experience to which I already alluded at the time when cardiovascular research was done using male subjects only. And when that was the case, not surprisingly, most of the diagnoses and treatments were focused on males. And so we now know that cardiovascular disease, although it affects women with the same frequency, it has often different symptoms. It occurs at a different age because there's some protection from estrogen till a certain point. And so there would be women who showed up at the emergency room and would be not be diagnosed with having cardiovascular disease. It wasn't until we had a substantial number of women in important positions. Specifically, Bernadine Healy was head of NIH at the time that they began the Women's Health Initiative, that they really began inclusion of women in clinical trials of drugs. And that made a huge difference for diagnosis and also for treatment, because when angioplasty was first developed, when cardiac bypass was first developed, there was a higher death rate in women than in men. Was this surprising? Not at all. The tests had been normed using male subjects. So when you ran that sort of Roto-Rooter thing for an angioplasty through women's vessels, which are on the average smaller than the men in whom they were normed, you know, they were more likely to burst. It also didn't work very well in Asian men who on average had smaller vessels than the white men on whom the tests had been normed. So, you know, this shows the difference it makes. As my friend Shirley Malcolm often says, what if there had been a woman on the airbag design team? Would the American automobile industry have suffered the fiasco that it did? I'm not saying that a man couldn't think, you know, how are these airbags going to affect smaller individuals such as children or short women? But maybe if you're a short woman who's always, you know, having trouble reaching up, that's more likely to come to your mind. Or some of the changes that have been made for particular groups end up helping the whole population. So, for example, curb cuts, which were made primarily for people with disabilities, are also very useful for pulling suitcases, for people pushing strollers. So this idea that something that's developed for a particular population will only be good for that population is not necessarily true. It's useful for the entire population. So having diversity in the pool of scientists, I think, is really very beneficial for all.
And so I'll just, you know, I agree with what my colleague said, you know, so eloquently, and just add, you know, I think it's a business imperative, you know, for companies to survive, because, you know, the next generation is growing up in this interconnected, diverse world. You know, we're in the age of Obama. We're not going backwards. We're going forwards. And companies who don't embrace diversity, and if people don't see reflections of themselves in products, how they're designed, how they're marketed, the companies are going to become irrelevant and not popular in the marketplace. So, you know, I think it's an economic imperative as well.
So where does this lack of diversity come from, and what are the barriers faced by women and minorities, particularly in STEM?
So, you know, I can speak to that firsthand, and also, you know, I have two college-age children, you know, one who is an engineering student right now, and the number one barrier is low expectations of the student of color in a classroom setting, and that's based on, you know, decades of, you know, stereotyping and just other, you know, that's all I can say. You know, my experience was, you know, when I expressed interest in taking advanced classes, you know, it was questioned. And, you know, my parents, you know, had to intervene with high school teachers so I could, you know, be on track to take AP classes. And so that's one barrier. And then once you get past that, you get in the workplace and they don't think you're qualified to be there. So you're tested and scrutinized and so, you know, I call that a race tax. You know, that's burdensome and doesn't, you know, make your enterprise efficient and well run because you're, you know, off trying to see if this, you know, minority hire is qualified or not. So you're wasting your time doing that. And what I like to tell people about affirmative action, you know, you would not be let into the school, you know, if you couldn't do the work, you know. So I went to Carnegie Mellon, I went to Stanford on a scholarship, and there's no affirmative action class that, you know, you go to. You go to class with everybody else, and you're taking the class, you know, the test with everybody else. You're doing the homework with everybody else, and you're not going to graduate unless you could do the work. So that's, you know, there's bias, you know, in the system, but, you know, I see it changing. You know, I see, again, you know, my laboratory, Sandia, you know, National Lab, actually walks the talk and allows me to do STEM outreach. You know, they give an account number for us to go out and you know, communicate with students and be role models. So it's changing, and I'm optimistic for the future.
For women, some of the same barriers that Maynard identified apply, but actually the overwhelming barrier, and I am just repeating some research that I did 10 to 15 years ago and asking women scientists, and these are successful academic women scientists, what is the major challenge issue that you face? And it's still balancing career and family. This is the big issue, and this holds across all disciplines and across all sectors, although it's slightly worse in academia than industry, which is seen as a little bit more family-friendly. Academia leads to the problem of the competition between the so-called biological clock and the tenure clock. The reason for this is that, as you know, most kids graduate from high school at about 18 these days. Then they go to college, and we used to talk about four-year graduation rates. Now it's more like six-year graduation rates or a little bit more. And even if they go directly to graduate school, that's now taking longer, too, so maybe 6 years there. Then two or three years of postdoc, depending on the field. So if a person has not had children and she is interested in having children, by the time she gets her first tenure track position, she's in her late 30s. So there is competition between the biological clock and the tenure clock. And that is really quite a huge issue. Another aspect of balancing career and family is the dual career situation. Why is this an issue for women scientists and engineers compared to women in other careers? Women scientists and engineers, something like 60%, and in some fields much higher, are paired with either men or women partners who are scientists and engineers. Obviously, given the numbers that we talk about of men in science and engineering, the reverse is not the case, or barely any of the men would be married or partnered with women. So this is a real issue, and often The dual career couple met in graduate school, so they're in exactly the same field. So that getting a position that is satisfactory for both individuals can be very problematic. Those of us here in the Bay Area have some advantages because there are many opportunities there. But it's still a huge issue. I would say the other big issue that comes up for women is still the issue of gaining credibility, respectability from peers and superiors. It's not unlike the issue that you're mentioning with regard to affirmative action. There is still some thought that maybe women can't do this, or particularly at the higher levels, are they interested in having the senior kinds of positions?
In terms of high school students and barriers, I think it's academic is one in terms of rigorous exposure to rigorous curriculum. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned in working in SMASH and with the scholars we serve, a GPA from a low-performing school doesn't mean a whole lot. Nor does an A in a class at a low-performing school doesn't mean a whole lot. These students are still not prepared, but they think they are, because they get an A's at, you know, their school, yet they get to, or, you know, Stanford or Berkeley or wherever they choose to go to school, and they do not persist. They drop out or they change majors. And so I think the exposure to rigor, that's one of the reasons that the aspiration is there. I mean, it's the same as Asian students and white students, and the research speaks to that. But the drop-off happens after the first 2 years, and part of that is due to the academic preparation, the lack of academic preparation, also the social psychological, which Marina has already spoken to. I think that's another challenge. And then structural, you know, the counselors, the low expectations, you know, of I want to go to, you know, Berkeley or Stanford or MIT, but yet the counselor has no idea even how to prepare the student at this school for opportunities to be able to go to those schools. So I think, you know, like that ratio in California at one point, I think it's worse now, was like 800-1. On average, of counselor to high school student in a school. And in low-performing schools, it's worse. So just imagine, you know, and if you don't have the initiative, and most of these students are first-generation students, they have challenges of learning about these opportunities. And through SMASH, we expose them to what it's like to be on a campus and to take classes in a lab where you could be one day as a freshman or as a sophomore engineering student. So I think those are the kind of three broad categories: structural, academic, and social psychological. And I can definitely relate to the challenge that you face as well. I experienced the same thing as a graduate student, where I walked into a class and a professor thinks that I shouldn't be there. And it comes out in the way I'm treated. I mean, ask me basic questions about math, and I have a degree in physics, but yet I'm treated as though I don't know basic, you know, algebra, which is, you know, and that psychologically, that can have an effect on you. And it did for me. Then having study groups, you know, I'm the only one in the classroom and trying to find a study group. And they say, we're going to meet at this time. And yet they meet another time. And I'm like, what's going on here? And I think it's the perception that I have nothing to add to the, I have no value to add to the group or to the problem set that we're working on that's due the next week. So I was in isolation. I'm trying to figure this out on my own. And that's not the way you get through graduate school. It's vitally important to work in groups. So these are challenges that and I face, you know, firsthand. I think those are the barriers.
Mm-hmm. So moving from barriers to strategies, all of you have mentioned the importance of role models, and clearly that's a big one for this field. But what are some other strategies for increasing diversity? Jarvis, do you want to start us off this time?
I think I mentioned a couple. One, I would start with the work that we're doing, the Level Playing Field Institute, our SMASH Academy. I think it's important to introduce students to programs like SMASH and like SMASH Prep. I think that's a strategy. And exposing students to teachers who have the know-how and the expectations are high for them to achieve. I think that's important. And then exposing parents, you know, specifically first-generation students, you know, educating parents on opportunities beyond what they see in their local community, and providing students an opportunity to actually do science, not read in a textbook about science, but actually do science, actually see how math is relevant to issues that are important to them. I think those are strategies that if implemented, I'm not saying they're not being implemented, they are in certain schools, but I think the majority of students that we are serving and where the issues are, it's not. And through what we do in other programs like SMASH in the Bay Area, are trying to address that issue.
Well, I would be remiss as a provost if I didn't mention what we do at San Francisco State in terms of some of our programs to support students in science and engineering. And we have quite a good track record of preparing students to go on for doctoral work, students of color in particular, but also women. sort of implementing some of the ideas about which you were speaking, getting them doing research in the laboratory, but sometimes with the support and supervision of the faculty. Study groups, faculty who look like them, additional support. Sometimes it's a matter of allowing them to not have to work, providing them with the stipends and support that they need, because most of our students at San Francisco State are first generation, many are low income, and many are students of color. So having access to the kinds of support and resources that will allow them to work in the lab, to devote the time they need to do to pursue science is really extremely important. I'd also just like to mention a couple of things going on at the national level, because I'm on the AAAS executive board right now, and there's much concern throughout the country about some of the cuts that are occurring due to the sequestration, which will not only undercut basic research, which is significant and is actually, of course, very significant for the state of California, but there are proposals to reorganize the way STEM education will be funded. And these may not be for the best, so that the latest proposal is to put all the K through 12 in the Department of Education, have NSF only fund undergraduate and graduate STEM education, and then have the Smithsonian do the funding for the informal science and public science education. For those of you not familiar with the way the money is usually divided up, this is quite a switch, because NSF now does fund a good bit of K through 12 and has a lot of informal science education. NASA, in about 70 of its programs, does funding for students to do undergraduate research. Many of the other agencies fund substantial science education kind of research. So this would be a huge switch. And the fear is that there will be loss of overall funds, as well as confusion and withdrawing from successful programs that have supported STEM education very well. So I think this is something that this group really needs to keep an eye on, because we all have an interest clearly in STEM education, or we wouldn't be here tonight.
So again, excellent comments by my colleagues. You know, I would only add that continued support by corporations, by schools, by communities, grow. You know, one of the things that I did was created this community-based robotics theme hackerspace, and that was simply because there weren't any near where I lived and worked, and so the idea there was just to, like the Field of Dreams. This was like the hackerspace of my dreams, which was some place to play with robots, because I don't get to do that during my day job. I get to do that at citizen schools, but that's only a couple hours a week, and so this is something I'm passionate about, and with the connectivity of the world today, I can put up a web page and start writing a blog, and people will hear about it, and we have over 150 members now, but so you can make a difference just locally, that's what I have time to do, and that's what I choose to do.
Great. Our thanks to our distinguished panel for their comments here today. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Women and Underrepresented Students of Color in STEM Education with Maynard Holliday, Sue Rosser, Jarvis Sulzer, and our moderator, Catherine Nielsen. Now we'll open up the floor to Q&A. Please keep your questions short and to the point. Also, as always, please be sure that your questions are, in fact, questions. We have a standing mic, so please line up in the front, and I'll bring that out.
Hi. My name is Tracy Gray, and I am the founder and director of the Sankofa Global Project, with the emphasis of connecting women and men of students of color to opportunities, education, global, and career in the STEAM areas. I have a question about, there's a young woman who I'm sure you read about who was arrested recently conducting a science experiment. And there are schools across the country that have these wonderful science labs, and students aren't getting a chance to use the science lab. What can we do as educators to change some of that?
So I can think of, again, the citizen schools model of reaching out to the community of professionals in areas of STEM and ask them to, present their expertise, in your classroom or in your, project space. And I see that, my kids' school out in Danville, Chevron is, just throwing money at, a lot of different organizations, these schools included. And so, they have sometimes better facilities than, I have at my national laboratory. But there's no training for, the teachers to get up to speed on a 3D printer, on a CNC lathe, on a laser cutter. And so, we've taken that as a challenge, and again, because of the volunteer opportunities that we have, we can go into the school and help the teachers get up to speed on these advanced pieces of equipment.
Hello. My name is Jan Half, and I'm the program director of a nonprofit called the Mouse Squad Student Tech Leadership Program. We're kind of like a junior geek squad. And we work with students in grades 4 through 12, and all of you have mentioned how important your elementary, middle, high school, and, of course, higher education experiences were. Our concern is that because we are a STEM program, but we also have to incorporate the language arts and math and the subjects that are being tested. What can you do, or what can we do, to really emphasize the fact that these STEM programs are as important for youth to be inspired in STEM subjects, but also the workplace skills, and that they're going to learn to read and write and improve in those areas just within the context of science, technology, engineering, and math. So what can we do? What are some additional strategies that we can do to make that happen?
Well, I would mention, the importance of getting the correct officials elected who really want to support both at the local level as well as the state and national level STEM. We have some real challenges right now in certain school districts throughout the country where they prevent the teaching of certain subjects like evolution or climate science or some really very fundamentally well-proven scientific facts. I'm not even going to call them theories because then they challenge that. So I think that's extremely important. At the national level, again, there are some major challenges going on. As you may know, it's been suggested that the social, behavioral, and economic sciences be defunded by NSF, and that's a big fight that's occurring right now at the federal level. So I would say science is under attack, and it's very much a political situation. And so I think that we really have to be sure that we give adequate funding to the public schools so that there will be money not only for, English language, but also for science and training, and that we say the textbooks must include evolution, they must include climate science, you can't bar these kinds of things. And some of that battle has to be fought in the political arena. It's not something people really want to hear because that seems somewhat overwhelming, but it's extremely important and I think makes a very big difference.
So if I could add to that, what I do in my classrooms is I make it real for the kids. So, you know, they've got cell phones, and I say, you know, how do you think this thing works? an engineer built this, and I show them, you know, applications. You know, in my classroom, I have a robot of the week, where, you know, I show them a Hollywood robot, you know, that grabs their attention. You know, show them the Terminator or some robot that they're familiar with, and then I show them a real one, and I get more of a reaction around the real one, and then we explore how that real one works. You know, like the Da Vinci surgical robot, like the Google self-driving car. And so that piques their interest and gets them hooked. And then, you know, we start to explore because, you know, I tell them to project, you know, when you're an adult, you know, these self-driving cars are going to be a reality. You're going to be able to go on the internet, you know, have a car come to your house, pick you up, you know, take you to work. You know, it's just, you know, I have to have them, you know, get their head around, you know, what their future is gonna be like. And once they start thinking about, you know, what the possibilities are, then, you know, they get engaged. And so making it real for them that, you know, this is their future and they can help invent it.
For the sake of time, I won't add, but.
Go ahead.
Go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay. To add to your point, I think it's part of it also is identifying problems in a community and how they can approach them from a STEM perspective. I know with Smash Prep, the first day of class with these young men, we had them do a brainstorming session of all the issues that they can think of in their community. And then we said, okay, well, how can you address this issue? And we have now they're developing this app. They learn how to code, you know, and build this app to deal with unemployment, you know, to help, you know, app that can help their cousin find a job. You know, they can get the app they're building, and so they can be demonstrating this app as part of their, you know, end product. So I think that's important because now they're bought in, and now they make the connection. And looking at video games, they consume video games. They want not only to be consumers, but the creators of the video games. You know, and understanding what's behind the science, engineering, and coding behind the game, not just when they're playing the game, playing Madden or whatever they love to play, but also dissecting it from a social justice lens as well. You know, why people gravitate to Grand Theft Auto? Who are the images in these videos? What if we change those images? What if the engineers designing the cars? So really get them to think differently, not just about the science, but also the social justice element and the lens of which you should look at identifying problems and solving those problems from a STEM perspective.
So thank you for your clear perspectives and personal contributions. And I'm actually going to repeat the same words the last questioner just used of what can we do, but specifically, and hearing about the political situation and the threat, what can we in this room and in the listening audience do now to address the political threat to science?
Uh-oh. Well... A few things. There are some petitions going around now. I think it's very important to call your congresspeople. If we do have some very powerful people in California, of course, who are high up in Washington and on some important committees. Unfortunately, Lamar Smith, who is in charge of the Science Appropriations Committee, is from the state of Texas. And he does not believe in climate and a few other things, and he's one of the ones wanting, they're really looking at some devil's choices. They're suggesting, for example, they would fund NSF better if they would drop the social, behavioral, and economic science. And I think we have to hang together and say this is not acceptable, because once they start with these kinds of disciplines are not science or we will defund this, then the next time it's this discipline we defund. And we have to say no. Second thing is there is a major attack going on now against peer review, as you may know, which has been seen throughout the world as what makes American science excellent in terms of the research that we do. And so to say that this is not something that should be determined by politicians. That's something that should stay out of the political arena. They should provide the money, but the scientists and engineers should do the peer review and say this is good science and it's based on science. It is not based on politics. And I think we have to speak out very loudly on that because that is under threat right now. And then at the local level, I think to be sure that we vote to, you know, in some cases raise taxes so that they go to the schools and that public education is funded at all levels, from K through college. That's very important. I'm a little surprised that throughout this country, people are no longer willing to fund education the way they used to. And that's important for everything, but especially for science and technology.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Really, really appreciate this panel. My name is Alohe Ansani, and up to a month ago, I was the only tenured woman professor at engineering at San Francisco State, but thanks to the leadership of Provost Russer and my dean, Dean Axler, sitting here, we now have another woman who is going to be in engineering. And my question specifically is to the, we know that we've been having a hard time retaining women in engineering. Once they come, they kind of we lose them to other areas. Specifically, the question is mentorship in career advice. As Provost Russer so well said, you know, people want role models like themselves. And we know that men get mentorships. Women don't, systematically, specifically in academia and engineering. And what's your solution to that?
Well, I have written a few books on it, but I don't know that it's exactly the solution. First of all, I think it is really very much a group solution. I do believe that women need both men and women as role models. First of all, the research supports the fact that men have broader and more powerful networks. So if a woman restricts herself to being mentored only by women, she will not have access to as many mentors and to as many powerful networks. And it's sort of like an extension of what we talked about, the importance of having diversity in the pool of scientists and engineers. You want as many perspectives as possible. On the other hand, if you don't want to learn how you can, you know, balance nursing your baby and continuing your career as a scientist, probably you want to ask another woman about that. You'd be more likely to get an accurate answer to that. So I think that that's extremely important. I think we have to give honest feedback. I did some research where I found that the men academic scientists and engineers had more what you would call the bell-shaped curve in terms of their curriculum vitae, that they tended to, you know, come around the center, whereas the women tended to be at the tails, meaning that some were superstars outperforming, although they weren't necessarily getting the awards. And I'm sorry to say there were some that were down at the other end, and it was more flattened. And what I came to realize that probably meant was that women were not getting the mentoring somehow, that in some way men are getting mentoring. Is it informal that, you know, there's a conversation that occurs in the locker room after a squash game, and, you know, the women aren't there, and somebody says, hey, how do you do, da, da, da. And people are not intending to exclude, but if you're not there, it doesn't happen. Or if there's a lot of informal information passed over beer that's held on Friday afternoons at 5 o'clock, and if the woman has to go pick up the kids and is not there, although often men have to do that too and they miss out, then you're losing that information. Much of science is very informally passed, you know, the little tricks, the little parts of the profession. I mean, the bottom line is we don't 100% know how it happens. But a lot of it is an apprenticeship and mentor model. And some new sort of shocking research, but I did want to point out is, you know, the direction that science is going is translational or technology transfer. And so you have the application. And one area that seems to be a new
scary part for the absence of women is in patenting. Across all disciplines, all countries, and in all areas, by that I mean industry, government, and academia, women pass patent at a vastly lower rate than men. Why does it matter? This is now where the action is. This is where the money is, and this is where the new ideas are. So if women are not there, it signals a problem. And a lot of patenting in particular and innovation has to do with mentoring. So I think that's a very apt question that you ask.
Thanks to the distinguished panel for their comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.